Your mission, should you decide to accept it, is to listen to tonight's episode of Agents of Cool, wherein we begin to unpack the massive amount of cool and the extraordinary cultural legacy of Bruce Geller's Mission Impossible. Remember, if you or any of your IM force are captured or killed, the Secretary will completely throw y'all under the bus. Welcome to tonight's episode of Agents of Cool. This is Eric, your grumpy, disgruntled number six over in the corner, mutterings to himself. But remember, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. Joining us tonight are our resident Q, our sound expert, Ray. Ray, say hello, Ray.
Hello.
And our resident money penny, Stacy.
Hi there.
Tonight we're talking about Mission Impossible. Now, we've talked about James Bond and the massive cultural impact of James Bond, which is really, really hard to get your head around. 99.9% is significant. And probably an equivalent amount of cool is Mission Impossible. Mission Impossible was the mid-1960s television series that featured a team of highly skilled operatives, not necessarily secret agents, we'll get to that, but a highly skilled team of operatives who took on extremely covert missions in the interest of the U.S. government. It was one of those things that was building on earlier works, but also culturally established the trope of the spy team of the tech guy and the disguise guy and the femme fatale and the strong man and the leader and... ran for 7 years on CBS from 1966 to about 1973. First starred Stephen Hill. He only lasted about a season. And then you get Jim Phelps, played by Peter Graves, who was just totally iconic and spent the latter part of his career playing on that iconic nature. Featured Martin Landau and Barbara Bain, Peter Lupus and Greg Morris and Leonard Nimoy and in small parts Sam Elliott and just a host of extraordinary character actors in the 1960s. There was a revival in the 1980s, ran for about 2 years on ABC, filmed in Australia, also starring Peter Graves. Then you have the major league, big budget, super slick Hollywood film series, Mission Impossible, quarterbacked by Tom Cruise, starting about 1996 or so. Mission Impossible 2, about the year 2000, 2006, I think Mission Impossible 3, 2011, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, and coming up the summer of 2015, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Speaking of which, Ray, the preview for Rogue Nation we just viewed as a group before beginning this recording. So, what did you think?
Well, whoever, as I think I commented on the article I wrote shortly after it dropped, whoever did that trailer really likes motorcycles or really hates motorcycles because a whole lot of them die in the course of about 30 seconds in there.
That's true. So. That's true. I do like that nerd icon Simon Pegg is more and more widely featured in the Mission Impossible movies as the series goes on. I love seeing, you know, here's the deal. You're watching the preview and it's Marcellus Wallace from Pulp Fiction and it's Scotty from Star Trek and it's Hawkeye from the Avengers and it's some guy in a cult.
And also Alec Baldwin.
And Alec Baldwin.
Or was he the guy in the cult? No.
No, he's not in the cult.
He's just kind of has his, well, anyway.
He's got that big, chunky Alec Baldwin head. Do you remember when Alec Baldwin used to be like a young, handsome, leading man movie star guy?
I remember from The Shadow.
He was Jack
Beetlejuice
Ryan.
Beetlejuice before that.
Or Hunter Red
Ryan
October.
In October, where he was like the leading man and he was handsome. And then he just turned into a chunky character actor.
Well, also, do they not have hairstylists in Washington, D.C. anymore? I mean, his hair, Jeremy Renner's hair, was all just kind of
must
there. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's not.
Now, it's my understanding that they tend to spend the money on these things, however much money they need. So I don't know why you couldn't afford a comb or some gel. Come on, Alec, get a little product in that. You know, look presentable anyway. I mean, it's obvious you're like the villain. Or one of the villains.
Yeah,
you couldn't be telegraphing it more if you tried.
I mean, the only thing I'm hoping, you know, maybe they're doing a reveal and it turns out he's not actually the villain. It's kind of like getting Philip Seymour Hoffman for the Hunger Games movies. And
yeah.
It's like, how do we double down, you know, observe this, how do you double down on the evil of having
Donald Sutherland?
Donald Sutherland? Real simple. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
God rest his soul. He was fantastic.
Right. But it turns out he's not, okay, maybe not quite a good guy, but he's, you know, he's maybe, he's a fairly sleazy good guy, as it turns out, but not completely, you know,
But not the villain.
Yeah, not an utter black hole of evil. As far as, you know, we haven't read the books and we haven't seen the last movie hasn't come out yet, so we'll see. But, so, maybe they're basically, you know, holding Alec Baldwin saying, look, totally obvious villain over here. Look at the shiny screaming loud person over here.
Oh, and he's at least the government superior obstacle, like the supercilious admiral from Star Trek or whatever.
Right,
he may not actually be the villain.
Yeah, he's the Walter Peck of Central Intelligence.
There you go. That's a really good comparison.
You know, his job is to basically be officious and in the way and prevent the heroes from doing what they need to do.
It looks like we're not getting another... Or we're getting another movie that does not have an IMF agent as the villain, which is always nice.
Oh, I hope so.
Though it looks like we're having a threat to the existence of the entire IMF again, which I believe was part of Ghost Protocol.
Right.
They do have a habit of not being terribly creative in coming up with your villain, your threat, your problem, your menace. Mission Impossible was about an IMF agent going rogue. We'll discuss probably the movies in a later podcast, and I've got a huge axe to grind about the first one. Second one is Dougray Scott as an IMF agent gone rogue. Mission Impossible, and that's not a spoiler if you haven't seen it. They pretty much lay that out.
I can't remember anything about Mission Impossible 2 other than a motorcycle stunt. That was the John Woo directed one.
This one John Woo did. Honestly, I remember us going out to Steak and Shake and having dinner after watching it in the summer of 2000 more than I remember anything about the movie.
Yeah, I've got nothing. It's a complete blank.
Total blank. Mission Impossible 3, the movie directing debut of J.J. Abrams, which was a great movie, and I've watched that several times over the years. I adore that movie. I think it's fantastic. Has that great set piece in the middle, them breaking into the Vatican.
Yes.
And then there's that great set piece where they're breaking into the big giant Chinese...
The office tower.
The office tower, yep. Which was a terrific sequence. It's not that I mind stunts. I thought that the first one and the second one certainly was guilty of just having a lot of great action sequences and totally missing the writing and the integrity of the storytelling that the television show had.
Well, the thing about the first one and the second one, particularly the first one, is the impression I got was they decided this is a Tom Cruise vehicle.
Right.
Okay, we're going to put Tom Cruise in a franchise. Okay, spy franchise, what do we got? Mission Impossible. I imagine almost a scene like, okay, we have all these different spy franchises, and going through a little folder and tossing them out on the table and finally saying, Mission Impossible, that's the one we're going to use. It's a very much team-oriented show. It wasn't really till the third movie when they finally got this idea of, hey, maybe we should put together a team of agents for, you know, so they... Hell, at least you have somebody to disavow, because right now it's Ethan Hunt and that's it, you know.
Right, right. It shouldn't be the IMG, the Impossible Missions guy. It's the IMF, the Impossible Missions Force, which kind of implies a plurality of operatives.
Right.
The first movie does kind of handle that within its plot, in that it, you know, the killing off of Phelps's team is the entire point of the thing. Though, yes, the fact that I went to a Mission Impossible movie, it had a cool team pre-credits, including Emilio Estevez.
As the tech guy.
Murdered them all in the first few minutes.
Yeah.
And then Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt character kind of comes up with an ad hoc team. Mm-hmm. Kind of an improvised team about halfway through the picture, which is fine. And points to De Palma and the craftsman on that film. The CIA break-in sequence is extraordinarily well executed, to the point where the shots of Hunt hanging from the ceiling in that stark white computer lab, those are actually iconic. You see those spoofed in TV shows and commercials and cartoons. That's iconic.
I guess it's been almost 20 years now, hasn't it?
It's been almost 20 years since they did that. So, leading into the Rogue Nation trailer, it looks just slick and exciting and state-of-the-art stunt work and all these actors that we love and Tom Cruise. And I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say that. I actually like him very much as an action presence, and all the tabloid stuff I could really do without, because it's not any of my business.
Seeing the person show up, play a part, do stuff, hang off the side of an improbably tall object, and...
Or an airborne object.
Right, or
that's a great stunt. I'm sorry, that's a spectacular stunt. That's a spectacular stunt.
So you've got this of them doing the acting, and then you go, you know, you go home and to your family, and they go home to their family, and never the twain shall cross.
And that's the way it should be.
Right. And then there is, you know, having them come over for dinner, which is some actors that, you know, probably aren't very good actors, are probably just perfectly cool people to hang out with. And similarly, there are some actors that are impressive to watch on the screen or stage, and you would not want to be within 100 yards of them. And that could
be any of them. I mean, it's like you look at the history of public figures, and you've got baseball players who are horrible alcoholics, and you've got football players that beat and murder indiscriminately, and you've got actors and actresses in the whole history of Hollywood, movies and television and radio and stage and just on and on and on, and they've all got their problems, but you know, I think that's it. I think they've all got their problems, and we keep expecting them to be, you know, as virtuous and upright as the characters they portray, and I don't want to know that they're not. Like you said, we go watch the movie, I go home to with my family, they go home to their whatever, and we don't need to know. All right, we got anything else on the Rogue Nation trailer for now? It looks state-of-the-art, slick, spectacular, suspenseful, focusing on the team. We got anything else?
I think, in addition to, you know, being sort of a kind of a Tom Cruise vehicle, though less so with these later movies, there does seem to be the continuing thing of, we're going to put Tom Cruise in the most improbably dangerous place possible, side of a skyscraper, side of an airplane.
Maybe next time they'll hang him off the moon.
The ISS has got to come down at some point. I fully expect to see Ethan Hunt riding it down in Mission Impossible 9.
There you go. That'll be fine. Or maybe Elon Musk can put him on Mars. Now, you'd pay for that movie right now, wouldn't you?
Okay, I can think of several other people I'd like to send to Mars and not get back ahead of Tom Cruise. So, I mean, that's a different conversation for a different podcast.
Listen, Mr. Cruise, should you by some chance discover this podcast on iTunes, talk to Elon Musk if you haven't already, because there's your Mission Impossible 6 right there. It's all there. Everything you need.
Yeah, the trailer, of course, focuses heavily on the stunts and action set pieces. I do hope there will be a good con or heist in there.
Now, I am optimistic about that. The guy that writes and directs Mission Impossible Rogue Nation is Chris McQuarrie. Chris McQuarrie is he of the screenplay for The Unusual Suspects. Was it Unusual or Usual Suspects? It was The Usual Suspects. Chris McQuarrie wrote The Usual Suspects, been a highly paid professional screenwriter and script doctor for decades now. He was the guy that wrote and directed the Jack Reacher movie that starred Tom Cruise, which was a pretty good movie. Mr. Cruise, again, should you be happening to listen to this, you're not tall enough to be Jack Reacher. I'm sorry. There it is. I said it. You're not tall enough to be a Reacher.
It was a perfectly serviceable action movie.
It was a really good movie.
It's like, you know, I like the, you know, as a not Godzilla movie, I like the TriStar Godzilla movie. They called it Iguanodon 2000. And, you know, that would have been okay as a, you know, stupid, dumb matinee.
Instead of calling it Jack Reacher, if you called it Jim Bleacher. You see, a perfectly lovely movie. Anyway, so Christopher McQuarrie, he also wrote a highly underrated crime picture called Way of the Gun. So I'm optimistic he's got the sensibility to come up with something nice and twisty and noiry and suspenseful for all this. But we'll see.
Well, the other, I mean, there's little bits and hints, you know, like the wetsuits at the pool scene, and then, you know, Ethan Hunt is jumping into some large water vortex fountain thing. Going, kind of like, you know, MI3, you're like, what is he doing? And now he's dressed as a priest. And okay, what are they? Because you don't know who they're hit, what the target is or what the goal is in MI3.
Which is one of the beautiful things about MI3 is that it's starting to hark back to the structure of the original series. Of course, Mission Impossible. And if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't ever watched an episode of that TV show, number one, what in the hell is wrong with you? And number two, go do that right now. You've got Netflix on your computer. Pause this. Go watch an episode and come back. But the episodes of the original series, Mission Impossible, begin with a fast series of clips from the episode you're getting ready to watch. Someone's hand, and I found out that it's actually Bruce Geller, the creator of the show, that's his hand lighting the fuse in the title sequence of the television show. Light the fuse, and then behind the burning fuse, you see a series of fast cuts of the episode you're getting ready to watch. And it's a wonderful way, it's a magnificent way to build suspense, because you're thinking, how is this going to work? How are all these pieces going to come together? What is the significance of this shot? What's the significance of that shot? And you watch the television intro, and you're like, I've got to watch this show to see how all these pieces come together. And then they proceed with that sort of motif a little bit into what they call the apartment scene. In an episode of the original Mission Impossible, you would have light the fuse, the title sequence, you would have the mission assignment scene, where Dan Briggs in the first season, or Jim Phelps in later seasons, would go to, say, a tailor shop. Or a park bench.
Or my personal favorite from the very first Jim Phelps episode, Griffith Observatory drives up, goes to one of the little sightseeing telescopes up on the, you know, up there, you know, takes out a key, unlocks the side, there's a little tape recorder, he hits the play button on the tape recorder, and looks through the telescope. And then as the tape plays and explains what his mission is, the telescope shows the viewer little slideshow projections of the various people that the IMF needs him to go do something horrible to.
Then from that magnificent intro, and you're right, the Griffith Park Observatory one is a classic. This is where we're getting your mission, Mr. Phelps, should you decide to accept it. And everybody's heard that intro from, quoted from Mission Impossible, a million times in television and cartoons and films and everywhere else. And then you go to what they call the apartment scene. And the apartment scene is where you see, first you see Phelps or Briggs gather the team. He gets out the book of dossiers, and, you know, here's a picture of Martin Landau as Rollin Hand, and here's a picture of Barbara Bain as Cinnamon Carter, and, you know, the leader of the team will select their team, and then you'll have a scene with the team where he'll ask each of the team members about, okay, are you going to be able to double this guy, Rollin? And Barney is that computer gizmo over there you've got worked up. Is that going to work? Can you do this? And then you'll get little pieces of what's going to happen, but they won't explain. They won't explain to you what's about to happen. You just got to watch the show and see how all the pieces come together.
I think one of my favorite ones is, I think they ask Barney, are you going to be able to do this thing? And Barney says, yep, I'll just need a crossbow. And you have no idea how the crossbow is going to relate to the thing. He just needs a crossbow at some point. And you're spending, this was a two-parter, so yeah. You had to spend two whole episodes waiting for, when's the crossbow coming out? What are they using the crossbow for?
So what'd you call that, Chekhov's crossbow? That's interesting. In a way, Mission Impossible is actually functioning on classic principles of drama. If you see that in the first act, you're wondering the whole time, when is that going to be used? It's even if it's like a cat, or like a machine, or a blowtorch, or a crossbow, or whatever it is. I think there was an episode with a cat. There was actually an episode with a cat.
There was an episode of a robot, apparently, just at least going by the Netflix summaries.
That one, too.
I love that they give you only the little bits and pieces of what the plan is going to be. And they show off gadgets that you have no idea what their utility is. Like in the heroin dealer episode, you can sort of see that this would have some utility with a powdery substance being involved, but Rollin hooks up some magician's equipment that will let you suck powder up with one hand and then deposit a different powder with the other hand, and you're just like, okay, I assume that's coming into play at some point.
That particular episode, they're going after a heroin dealer, so the powdery substance is heroin, which is disguised as purple bath salts because I suspect Technicolor. So let's put something incredibly colorful on here.
See, there you go.
Bath salts were not themselves a drug at that point.
Welcome to the future, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go.
But that was one episode where I found myself wondering that, they want him to go take down this pair of heroin dealers. If you're willing to send a bunch of secret agents to go play with these guys' minds, basically play all sorts of mind tricks on them and trick them into doing X, Y, or Z, wouldn't it be cheaper and quicker just to send two guys play with their minds with, say, a 9mm bullet and call it a day? I mean, that's not good. That's not necessarily good, evening TV fare, and you could cram in 55 minutes worth of commercials after, into there, but...
Well, I've always thought that the IMF was when there could be absolutely no possibility of evidence of American government involvement.
That's fair. I guess
it makes it even more deniable if people don't realize that there were even agents there.
And I can see some of the other cases where, they did want a high degree of deniability, like Old Man Out, though, which is somewhat based on an actual historical character. So I can see that. I guess it makes sense, and they don't. I guess it's just sort of left understood that we need to do this on the QT, as it were.
Now, I presume at some point in the show's development that they thought they would have a somewhat more rotating cast, because they keep using that dossier scene, but it becomes increasingly obvious that most of the same five people are always going to be picked, and sometimes somebody extra. In fact, in one episode, at least, you could tell who was going to be picked and who wasn't, because the not-picked pictures were in black and white.
Yeah, and that was... And what's also kind of interesting is they took some effort to make the photos look like actual, a playbill or a magazine cover or a Collier Electronics brochure and such.
Model of the Year, Cinnamon Carter.
I like it gives some... The pictures of the main cast give some indication of their background.
Yes. If they didn't do that, you would have almost no idea who these people are, what it is exactly they do, other than maybe Barney, who seems to be some kind of...
Bill Gates or somebody like
that. Yeah, but the others are maybe con men or something. You don't really...
You see, but isn't that kind of the beauty of it? That these guys are not professional spies.
They're being paid by the U.S. government.
Are they being paid?
Would you do that for free?
It was the 60s, man. They're patriots.
That's true, but
They're answering their country's call, man.
Patriots got to eat.
Well, that's what... They've all got jobs, don't they? Barney's a rich man. He runs an electronics company. Cinnamon Carter is Model of the Year. She's probably got a nice bankroll stashed away somewhere.
All right, that's fair.
And you see their jobs. These guys all have day jobs. Rollins a nightclub performer, master of disguise, sleight of hand. Cinnamon Carter's a model. Barney runs a company.
Willie's
a weightlifter. He's a professional weightlifter.
He was an Olympic weightlifter and later a circus strongman or something. Okay.
I think they do qualify as professional spies as they're being at.
Actually, I dispute that. I think to quote John Steed, they are gifted amateurs.
Yeah, I think the whole point of most of them, except that again, it's always the same four people and maybe a guest star. They don't work for IMF full time. They get called upon when their skills are needed. They have day jobs. I would argue that they probably do get paid for going on these incredibly dangerous missions. And I do wonder.
But even
I assume
that
this is
will
part
of the paper trail, wouldn't
that's
it?
That's true. I assume this is part of the whole disavowal process. That they have plans for when Model of the Year Cinnamon Carter turns up in a ditch in East Slobovia or something.
If they can get a self-destructing tape delivered to an abandoned merry-go-round out of the way somewhere for their chief operative to basically listen to and then, walk out of there as the thing self-destructs, they can probably arrange to have a duffel bag full of unmarked 20s delivered to somebody's house.
My argument is, I think it's just straight-up 60s New Frontier patriotism here. Cinnamon Carter's country needs her, so she shows up and does the job. There's no pay, there's no thanks, it's totally off the books, nobody ever knows, but they do the job. And that's one of the things I actually really like about this job. As much as I have a certain 21st century cynicism about these things, you look at the show, there's no indication they were paid. They were not professional spies. The IMF, now you look at the movies, and it's clear the IMF is a department of an agency. It's like a federal government agency with, like, computers and headquarters and records and all kinds of stuff. But the guys in the 60s, they're off the books. There's the folder with the dossiers and the apartment scene, and that's the only record of these guys anywhere.
What happened to the poor bastard who embossed that little leatherette folder?
Well, you know, he's probably dead in a ditch in East Slobovia somewhere, isn't he?
I do find that interesting.
Or maybe that's what Dan Briggs did for a living. Maybe he embossed things. Maybe that was Dan's job. That was Dan's job. That's what he did. He was like, he worked at the kiosk at the mall where you could get your yearbook embossed. Okay. That was his day job.
I did read one suggestion, and I don't know if this was kept for the background of the series or if they cared, since they never went into the character backgrounds, but apparently on the grounds that the show was originally about a special team like this in the military, apparently, called Briggs's Squad or something like that. And Briggs and Willie and Barney were the original, the first three characters to be created. So at least something I read that was trying to speculate on the history of the IMF based on the hints from the show suggested that those three did this kind of thing together in the military. Briggs was apparently a lieutenant colonel, and then later they were recruited to do it.
Now, I was a
civilian.
You're absolutely right about that. I read, before we did this, I read a book, the chapter on Mission Impossible in the book Spy Television by Wesley Britton. Now, as an aside here, and Mr. Britton, you don't have to send, should you listen to this, we don't need a check or anything. Autograph copy would be fine. But it's a great book, and if you're into the kind of material we cover in this podcast, your 60s super spies and whatnot, it's basically indispensable to your set of interests. Spectacularly well-written book. And I was reading the Mission Impossible chapter as a way to prep for the show today, and Stacey's absolutely right that the original pitch was called Briggs' Squad, and the idea, and you name-checked Ocean's 11 earlier, and I think the original inspiration may have been tracking pretty close with the Frank Sinatra movie. You look at Frank Sinatra, Ocean's 11, and those guys were a unit. They were paratroopers in World War II. And right. One of the reasons Danny Ocean, Frank Sinatra, calls them back together to do this job is because they're not on anybody's watch list anywhere. Nobody would suspect them because they're not the usual suspects. They're not criminals. They're not gangsters. They can go in and do the job, and no one's going to look for them because they got no record anywhere.
But he knows what skills they have because they've worked together
right
before.
So I think there may be a little bit of Ocean's 11 inspiration in there. Now, I've also read that there's and if you haven't seen this one too, this is really a lovely piece of work, Top Kapi, T-O-P-K-A-P-I. It's a heist picture from the mid-60s that predates Mission Impossible by a couple of years. And it is just slick, Hollywood gloss heist picture, an enormously entertaining movie. But back to the Briggs' Squad pitch, the idea that these are World War II guys, and Dan Briggs was finding work for them to do because they were also terminally bored by civilian life. And as Geller was developing the pitch, he hit across the idea of, well, why not make these guys spies? Because there was the spy craze, as we've discussed in prior episodes, was ramping up, and his thought was, well, let's make them spies so there can be a kind of official sanction to the kind of work that they do. And then, of course, it develops from you don't actually get any of that background in the actual TV show. But you're absolutely right. That's where it started.
And that goes back to why you need those dossiers, because, and this is, I think we found this kind of ironic given that Stephen Hill was the first leader of the team. This is kind of like Law and Order in that they very deliberately tell you next to nothing about the history of these characters or how they met or, what they like for breakfast or anything else. You get maybe a glimpse here and there and maybe a little bit more as the series goes on, but not a lot. But they're very much just kind of ciphers. They're kind of blanks. You don't know exactly, you don't know how they know each other outside of this, how they got into this line of work, what their specific motivations are. You can speculate, you can basically, the audience kind of may project to a certain extent on them, but if they didn't do the little opening scene, you wouldn't know which one does what till halfway through, or even what the heck their names were in some cases. So,
well, yeah.
Sam Elliott, I think, appears in a 5 episode?
Several 5 episodes, apparently. He was being set up as a replacement for Willie. And then apparently there was viewer outrage, which I would not have expected because Willie is the one whose name I had not gotten from general cultural osmosis before watching the show. Barney, Willie, and the guy who does the tape voice are the only three who stayed with it for the whole show.
The whole show, the whole run.
And I think if you count the reboot in the late 90s?
87, 88.
88, so 88, late 80s. So really that makes the guy who does the voice the only
person to be in probably every single episode I guess they did some non-tape episodes for the off-book.
Oh, that's true. Mission. That's
His
true.
Name was Bob Johnson.
Yep.
The most nondescript.
Name. The name they give is Bob Johnson.
That's fair.
And they say that he died in 1993, but, who knows?
But
no disrespect intended. It's just the spy thing, and it just gives it. Sorry, that came out wrong.
No, but, so But it, you know, it very much is kind of the same vibe of Law and Order. It is, it's a spy procedural. It's much more, you know, James Bond is as much or more about the character of Bond and the villains. This is very much about, okay, how are we going, you know, basically, it's a mini heist movie every week.
Every week, and it's magnificent. And some of them are a bit more plausible than others, but even if they're outlandish and ridiculous, they're still never less than entertaining. Now, something you mentioned a second ago, that you only really get a little hints of, the characters are only defined by their jobs, basically. So now, referencing an earlier discussion, I mean, who knows? I mean, for me, I look at them and they're patriots. They're patriots stepping up when their country calls. Maybe there is a duffel bag of 20s out there for them somewhere. I don't know. Part of the beauty of the show and one of the reasons for its continued popularity is that it leaves a space for the audience to kind of read its own ideas about the characters and their interactions. There's like a space in the show where we rush to fill in details about them from our own imaginations, even when the show doesn't provide them or is even interested in providing them.
And you do get little hints. I think the one we saw where they recruit a trapeze artist for the particular scheme they have in mind. And she has a history with
Dan Briggs.
She's very happy to see him until she realizes that he's not there to see her as a person. He's there to see her as a trapeze artist for something. And there's rather a bit, you know, that may be the most character development we get for in any of the episodes we've seen. And we still have no idea what missions they met on, how they met.
And there's a bit of girl talk between her and Cinnamon later in the episode that establishes, which I had kind of already assumed, probably because I knew behind the scenes that Martin Landau and Barbara Bain were either married or about to be married, that Cinnamon similarly has a thing for Rollin.
But yeah, so it's just little small bits, and they dribble out over time. Like one of the off-book missions they do later, you know, is for a friend of Jim Phelps. So you do get the occasional bit later, but
even those shows are still about the process. So you can go back to, and I'm kind of interested today, if it's all right with you guys, in going back to the very first episode. We have like the latest iteration of this thing coming out in July, Rogue Nation. And I think it would be interesting for us to go back and discuss a little bit the very first episode and just try to isolate some of the principal themes of Mission Impossible, if you will. I mean, what makes Mission Impossible Mission Impossible? There's a lot of stylistic things. There's a certain style the show has. You start with lighting the fuse, the title sequence, the theme song. Oh my god, the theme song, which we haven't touched on yet, which is Get Your Blood Racing, almost like 99.9% as fast as the Bond theme song does. This is an amazing piece of music.
They use a lot of music in this.
Oh yeah,
in this series, just in general. Just because, I mean, a lot of times you've got somebody sneaking around and they use the music to ramp up the tension and, you know, call the audience's attention that something has gone horribly wrong, and use it to just to accent everything. And it uses it a lot more than, you know, I was expecting.
And it's part of what lends a very cinematic flavor to the show. Now, again, if you go back and watch the very, very first episode, it's obvious they spent a ton of money on it. The production values are very, very high. It's written and edited and scored and filmed very, very well. The suspense level of the show, even now, I've seen it like 4 or 5 times, and I know how it comes out, but the suspense level is still very, very well maintained.
That's not uncommon for pilots.
Pilot films are, particularly in the 60s, and even now, are generally more expensive and slicker and shinier than the series is going to be.
You want to sell the execs on it, so you basically pull out all the stops, because if they buy it, then you have a job, and if they don't, then you just spend all that money for nothing.
So now, in the case of Mission Impossible, and I know this is the proverbial bold statement, but I think you could take the pilot from Mission Impossible, I think you could play it back-to-back with Dr. No, and I think it'd be a real horse race as to which was the better presentation. I'll stick by that. Now, not throwing any shade at Dr. No here, not at all. Just saying that I think the pilot from Mission Impossible is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking.
It is very tight. It is very tight.
It's just one hour. 50 minutes. So I don't want to get too granular with the plot, but if you look at the first episode, it's just called Pilot. And again, you're sitting at your computer, you're listening to the podcast. If you want, pause us, go load up Netflix, and then just load up the pilot episode, very first of Mission Impossible. I'm not going to go too far into the plot here. I don't want to ruin it if you haven't seen it. It opens with the light, the fuse, the title sequence, that great theme song. Dan Briggs, played by Stephen Hill, goes into kind of like a junk store. They call it Odd Lots. It's an Odd Lots shop. And obtains what, at first glance, is a rare recording of some obscure concerto. And he peels off the seal of the record, puts it on a record player, plays it, and it's got his mission on it. There's a country called, there's a third world banana republic dictator named Rio Dominguez, in the country of Santa Costa, who is headquartered in the Hotel Nacional. Now, in the vault of the Hotel Nacional are 2 nuclear warheads that American intelligence thinks it's imminent that they're going to be used. And Dan Briggs' mission, should he decide to accept it, and we all know he's going to, or there's no show. should he decide to accept it, is to go take those two nukes out of the vault and get them out of play. Now, we get just a tiny little hint of character on Dan Briggs here when the mission voice says, "Welcome back, Dan. It's been a long time. Or maybe you're back for good now." So you get, and that's not an exact quote, but there's a hint that Dan's been gone for a while and now he's back. Just a tiny little hint of character.
Right, just those always little, those little tiny hints of character.
Just little breadcrumb. They're tantalizing, and you start making, and you know, I'm the kind of fan that starts making up stories in my head. You know, so maybe he had a mission that went bad, or maybe he lost somebody, or he had his heart broken, or he was in a gulag for a while. It could be anything.
You know, maybe it was the trapeze artist. I don't know.
Maybe it was the trapeze artist. It could be. You could lose a weekend with a trapeze artist now. You could. So you go to the first apartment scene, and he peels out the dossiers. And it's we have a guest star this episode, the character actor Wally Cox, as a safecracker named Terry Targo. So whatever you're doing, you're going to need a safecracker. So you have the team, but when you first see the team actually together, they're playing cards. And they're cheating at cards. Like Rollins cheating at cards, and the safecracker's cheating at cards. They're playing for pennies, but they're cheating. It's sort of, you can't possibly have the ace of spades, Mr. Hand, because I have the ace of spades. And never mind who, and maybe somebody else has. And then I think Rollins ends up having five pair. Rollins has like five pairs. So yeah, and you meet these guys and they're
like
cheating
at cards.
The purpose
of the whole game is to cheat better at cards.
The purpose of the whole thing is to out-cheat the other guys. And you get the mission and you get to, and they all kind of outline the mission, who's, as we discussed before, how are these parts going to intersect and operate in the story that's going to come? And they sort of go through their specialties, and they turn to Cinnamon, and they say, "Well, what's your job in this?" And she says, and I quote now, "Doing what comes naturally." And I tell you what, to have been the full focus of Barbara Bain's attention in 1966 must have been one hell of a thing. So they go to Santa Costa, infiltrate the Hotel Nacional, and it's and the production values are incredible. I mean, this is a film quality TV show. You could put this in a theater, probably stand, and you could stand this episode up against films of the period, and it would stand up very, very nicely to actual cinema.
Well, also the line between making a TV program and making a movie back then was
a very thin line.
Well, because it was all on film anyway.
Right.
There wasn't you're not doing it in studio going to videotape. This is actual. You're exposing film, and then you're getting it. There's a box called Telecine to get it.
But there was still something of that weird quality that TV shows have that movies...
Well,
especially back then, you could tell... Especially, like, there was a noticeable difference between indoor and outdoor scenes and so forth.
Some of that was because some of that was done on a soundstage versus actual location lighting.
And the weird hyper-realism that almost makes it look like a stage play that you see in the high frame rate editions of The Hobbit that we've had lately... That used to be what TV film.
Well, that's because,
more like.
Okay. Film runs at for historical reasons having to do with how fast they could get the gearing and such.
Right.
Film runs at 24 frames per second. TV runs at 29.995, I think. Not 30. 29.99. It has which is a holdover from a particular electronic limitation they had, if I recall correctly. And we tend to associate the faster frame rate with video rather than with.
And therefore, it strangely looks more artificial in some cases.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. There's a whole...
It's like, this doesn't look enough like a movie. It looks like real guys running around, and therefore looks artificial.
Which is weird.
Yeah. The kinds of subjective visual impressions that constitute quote-unquote reality. Now, I think Peter Jackson said, when he was researching the high frame rate for The Hobbit, that as near as he could determine, the reason for 24 frames per second was that was as slow as they could, that was as few frames per second as they could use and still have the sound sync properly, which is fascinating. This was the least amount of film we can use a second. It's economic. So that's an interesting point, Stacey. Mm-hmm. Maybe my subjective impression of the show, that it's more real than real, comes from being trained my whole life for the kind of graininess film has, even really good film. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of trained my mind to see, well, this is real. Interestingly enough.
No, also the other thing about the Netflix editions, they were flagged as HD on Netflix. So I'm curious, kind of like with The Prisoner and with Next Gen, because it was shot on film, not video.
Yeah.
You could go back and resample that at higher than the 480, the 480p it was broadcast.
Wouldn't you love to see The Prisoner in a theater? Oh. Wouldn't that be something? Now, rest assured, ladies and gentlemen, we have Mission Impossible to talk about in the calendar year 2015. Man from U.N.C.L.E. will be addressing Spectre towards the end of 2015. But I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, The Prisoner is coming, and we are going to have so much fun with that. Anyway.
Less so, I imagine, with the remake.
I'm trying to pretend the remake doesn't exist. That and Highlander 2. Never happened. Never happened.
There are some bullets we have to take for the audience.
I will allow, as there was like a Highlander movie, another Highlander movie, but there was no Highlander 2. That never happened. Never happened. And there was no remake of The Prisoner starring Jesus. That never happened. Did not happen. Although, don't you think it would have appealed to Patrick McGoohan's ego that the only person they could see fit to replaying him, to replace him, also played Jesus?
I think that would appeal to just about any actor's ego.
Well, but his in particular. Anyway, so Mission Impossible, the first episode, and it's this really suspenseful, tight cat and mouse game inside the hotel to get the nukes out of the vault. And every cast member has a moment to shine. Everybody's specialty is in play. Given that there's no real character to play there, it's incredibly well acted. They're charming, they're smart, and it's just a wonder. It really is.
The gimmick is that it is a time-locked vault that is only open twice a day, 12 hours apart. I think 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And guests do store their valuables in there, so there is a reason to go in there where the atomic warheads are.
Right.
But it has to be done in that period of time, you have to stay in there for 12 hours, and there's not quite 12 hours of air.
Right. The pilot episode gives them a really great dilemma. Here's the problem you have to solve, and it's enormously entertaining. I would like to name check the hotel concierge. I wrote this name down to make sure I got it right. Alessio, who's this really kind of nervous rat-faced little guy with white shoes and a linen suit, and he's just he knows something's going on. He knows something's going on, but he can't figure out what. And I feel you could almost do like the entire episode from his point of view, and it would still be like hilarious. And at the end of the show, of course, they sneak out and they ride away in the car. And we generically refer to that as riding away in the van. And in a lot of episodes, they actually do just get in the van and ride away. No one ever knows they were there. Now, this episode kind of errs in that a little bit. There's a big action shootout at the end of the episode, like a thrilling conclusion to the pilot that you don't actually see in most of the run of the series. Because most of the run of the series, what makes it cool is that nobody ever knows what happened. These guys pile in the van and they drive away. And the villains are left usually either dead or with guns pointed at them or with their empires in shambles around them. And they don't even know what hit them. They never know. And this is the rare episode where General Dominguez knows what happened. He knows somebody was there and messing with him, but for the vast run of the show, they never know. Zero residual presence.
There was a bit of characterization with the Martin Landau character because they keep showing him, you know, practicing the lines and trying to get into the character of the general, which he is, of course, also playing. Because, you know, this little small banana dictatorship committed the key essential sin of having their supreme leader look like Martin Landau, which leaves them open to IMF attack.
Right. Now, it's clear that for like the first three seasons of Mission Impossible, they accept the missions where the bad guy looks like Martin Landau. Yeah, otherwise the whole thing falls apart. Now, fortunately for the interests of the West, starting about season four of Mission Impossible, they've eliminated all the guys that look like Martin Landau, and then they're moving on to all the guys that look like Leonard Nimoy in disguise. And they clear all those guys out.
And Leonard Nimoy...
And God rest Mr. Nimoy. God rest... A moment for Mr. Nimoy. Because he doesn't get near the credit for the work on Mission Impossible. I mean, Mr. Spock is such a titanic achievement in terms of television and film and popular culture. As if that's not enough. The guy did so many other things, did them all well, that probably he does two seasons as the disguise artist Paris on Mission Impossible, and that gets lost in the shuffle a little bit, but it shouldn't, because he plays each of the characters that he doubles with such brio and verve and life. I mean, he's just enormously charismatic in the part, even though he's barely under makeup for so much of it.
Given the timing, that would have essentially had to been his job coming right off of Star Trek. Right?
Oh, yeah, and they had like contract negotiation problems with Landau and Bane. There were new producers, and it was just kind of a nasty, tangled mess, so that they needed somebody new, basically right after Star Trek got canceled, and they called up Leonard, and Leonard says, well, this sounds like a pretty good idea, and he was friends with Landau, so he calls up Landau and says, hey, is it all right if I go do this? And I guess Landau must have given him his blessing, because then he's on Mission Impossible.
He does an amazing Che Guevara XP impersonation.
Oh, yeah. And
there's apparently a second one.
Just amazing.
So we saw one where he's obviously playing not Che Guevara. There's apparently a subsequent episode, I don't know if he's in it or not, where they, you know, have another Che Guevara XP as well. I don't think it's the same guy. I don't think there was that many recurring opposition.
You don't get a lot of, you tangle with the IMF and you don't come back for round two.
Yeah, I honestly
when they work
thought,
you over, you're worked over.
Not knowing my Spanish, having taken French in school, I honestly thought they were just being really terrible when they kept referring to the guy as El Lider.
El Lider.
And it turns out, no, it's spelled differently, but that actually is one possible way, at least, of saying leader in Spanish.
Yeah, yeah. So, the first episode, I've made note of what I think are maybe the three most important themes of Mission Impossible. What makes it Mission Impossible? And in later episodes, as we discuss the later episodes and the movies and the new movie coming up, I think it would be really interesting if we could look at this and say, this is what made Mission Impossible in 1966. Is this still what makes it that now? And the first thing, maybe the most important thing, is teamwork. That Dan Briggs, Jim Phelps, they don't do this all by themselves. You can't. You've got your master of disguise and the femme fatale and the strong man and the electronics expert, and they are a team. They work together. They're like clockwork. And the level of teamwork they show, the level of trust and camaraderie and loyalty among the team members is essential to this show. Like if Barney says he's going to have that lock broke at 12:06 p.m. exactly, and Cinnamon knows her life depends on that lock being broke at 12:06 p.m. exactly, Barney's not going to let her down. And she goes in there with absolute trust in her teammate that he will have that lock broke. Or if Roland says, I can double that guy and we'll get you out of the jail because I'm doubling this guy, he doesn't doubt him. The trust and the level of teamwork and the camaraderie and the loyalty, even though it's never really explicit in the scripts, it's a very process-oriented show. You don't get a lot of character, but the subtle interactions of the actors and the way these missions have to work, teamwork and absolute trust in each other.
And in case something does go wrong, they are very capable of adapting and right. filling each other's roles. I think both of the Dan Briggs episodes we saw had Dan having to fill something he hadn't personally prepared for because something went wrong in the original plan.
I don't know how much you want to give away, but yeah, he has to basically double in for someone in at least a couple of the ones we've seen. Because it doesn't always, they have this incredibly complicated plan, and it requires the plan to go exactly according to clockwork, give or take, to work, and of course it never entirely does. There's always some extra little complication, some extra little thing that doesn't, and they have to improvise their way out of it.
Some third act twist to just put the twist on them really good.
And in some cases, you know, you're wondering, okay, how the heck are they going to get out of that? And then they will, you know, all of a sudden cut to somebody else who just saved the, you know, whoever's on the spot's bacon. You know, there's a bit where Martin Landau is about to give a speech to the nation, and he's already said earlier, I'm not going to be able to impersonate the guy on TV giving a speech. And he's put in that situation because the timetable's all screwed up, and then Barney is at the last second able to take down the, you know, the TV transmitter, so they have to cancel the speech. And he storms and yells at his incompetent subordinates and storms out and breathes a sigh of relief. So it's just that last little, how are they going to get out of this?
There's two schools about what makes, well, two schools that I've heard about that. Well, what makes a story entertaining? Number one, how are they going to get out of this? And number two, oh my God, how are they not going to die this time? Like if you watch a Joss Whedon television show or something written by George R. R. Martin, it's something akin to having him walk into your childhood bedroom and hold a gun to the head of your stuffed animals. Because which character that you love is going to die tonight? And then there's the show, which you're pretty sure none of them are going to die horribly, but it's more like, how are they going to get out of this? And I really like that particular, well, I like them both. A good story is a good story, but I really like how are they going to get out of this because it requires an extreme level of cleverness in the writers. How are they going to get out of it?
Even if you're pretty sure they are, yeah, you still want to see how they pull it off, especially if the plan has clearly gone off the rails. And as far as you know, they don't have a contingency for this.
Which is why it's an impossible mission. Sorry, I had to do it.
Right, and that's part of, I mean, one of the hallmarks of the show to me was the fact that the audience is not in on the gag. The audience is trying to keep up with these folks who, they know what's going on. They know why they need the crossbow and the Persian cat and the chihuahua. They totally know why they need it. It makes absolutely perfect sense, but the audience has no idea, and the audience spends half the time racketing, what on God's green earth do you need a crossbow and a chihuahua and a Pomeranian for?
It's a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
Now, second major theme of Mission Impossible, and I think Ray is going to appreciate this in particular. As long as I've known him, he's been among all of his friends, his coworkers, he's Q. He's the tech guy. He's the guy we all go to. The lives of literally dozens of people in Central Kentucky would fall apart right now if everything ever happened to Ray. So what I'm going to pin is the second major thing in Mission Impossible is technology is your ally. Technology is your ally. Because there's not an episode of Mission Impossible that does not have poor Greg Morris crawling through an attic or a basement or some air ducts or in the rooftop or somewhere.
Or shoved in a false compartment in the back of a limousine.
Basically, he's Bill Gates shoved in the trunk of a Lincoln Continental. And he's going to get somewhere and plug something into something else or the free world dies in fire.
That is awesome.
See, yeah, there it is.
One thing I noticed, since you have the archetype, even in the Mission Impossible movies and also in Leverage, which obviously draws a lot from Mission Impossible, you have, nowadays, the hacker is the guy who can sit in the van and help out. Yeah. But Barney had to go crawling around in everything.
Had to get into
Barney
those
was as much an electrician as
anything. Yeah, as much an electrician as anything else. Like Ving Rhames as Luther Stickle in the Mission Impossible movies, he gets to sit in the van. Greg Morris had to drag his ass through every uncomfortable back lot in Hollywood. I mean, God rest Mr. Morris, too. He was just a tremendous television star. Loved him to pieces. But technology is your ally. That you got to make this stuff work or the whole thing falls apart.
Some of the stuff they were showing, like there's one episode where they use like a little, you know, tethered robot car with a camera and a drill in its belly and such. They used to get into some pipe work to do some spying. And, you know, that would have been probably considered, wow, that's really serious. You know, would it be amazing? A micro miniaturized TV camera the size of your pinky finger and
level
such?
That was probably science fiction along the lines of some of the stuff that we've seen in the blurbs for the later episodes about mind-destroying rays and so forth.
Yeah, but you know, it took me a second to realize, oh, wait, this is 1963, 64 or so? So, you know, so late 60s. Oh, my God, this would have been fairly pushing it out there. This would have been an incredibly expensive piece of kit to do. Whereas, you know, today, you know, I can go down to, you know, well, can't go to Raider Shack anymore, but you can go down to Home Depot and get like a boroscope that does basically, you know, about the same darn thing for, you know, $100. But some of the stuff that, you know, just readjusting just, okay, what you could do with technology back then and exactly what, you know, if you're going to, there isn't a convenient computer network to manipulate. It's not, you know, you have to get to the wiring. You have to get to the ductwork. You have to get in there. You have to mess with the elevator by getting into the elevator control and wiring up the, you know, the actual, controls on motors and such. And it's a lot more involved and a lot more, you know, gritty stuff with, you know, alligator clips and such rather than, you know, clicky, clicky, mouse, mouse.
You see, now, every spy movie you see these days, you've got the hacker. Every spy movie, every spy TV show. If I'm being pushed, I kind of like the days where you had Greg Morris putting out, like you said, alligator clipping something together. Because everybody's, I get tired of trying to watch an exciting spy movie and having to watch another actor try to act excited or worried while looking at a computer monitor. Because they do it all the time.
Hitting keys sufficiently fast that they probably aren't actually paying attention to what they're hitting.
Right.
It's like, we can make this exciting if I hit the keys really fast and loudly.
Yeah,
right.
It's very hard. Okay, it's very hard to make staring at a computer monitor look exciting.
It's interesting that the things actors do that they do not win awards for that are, in fact, very difficult to do. There should be an Oscar for most exciting computer monitor scene because it's really, really hard to act like that's exciting. So, technology is your ally. And what I would call, these are the themes, like the stylistic things, like the theme song and light diffuse and the title sequence and whatnot. These are the themes, I think, that make this mission impossible. Number three, and I think there are three major themes, but number three, deception, trickery, and stealth, a.k.a. the con is on. Because if you look at them, they're not really doing spy stuff. They're not...
Is what spy stuff mostly consists of. Actually.
Probably closer to
actual spies than Bond, who is more of an assassin.
Which is kind of where I was going with that. James Bond is just a straight-up murderer, frankly. I mean, just... As an aside here, I work as a substitute teacher. And where I've got to... I usually in my line of work, I'll get up in the morning and I'll find out where they need a substitute today, and then I'll go do that job. And it is kind of like... If you squint your eyes a little bit, it's kind of like being a secret agent where this is your mission today. Do you accept it? Except without all the sex and the murder. But anyway, deception, trickery, and stealth. The mechanic of Mission Impossible, if you will, the process, they're con artists. It's a sting operation. They'll trick some Banana Republic dictator into shooting his sideman, or they'll con you out of the microfilm, or they once made William Shatner think he had gone back in time 30 years. Which is no mean feat, and it's a con. And then at the end of the episode, like we've said, at the end of the episode, particularly in the Phelps episodes, at the end of the episode, they get in the van, they drive away, and nobody even knows what hit them. Deception, trickery, and stealth. And these are the things, really, that make Mission Impossible what it is.
In a sense, espionage is a con between nations. You're basically trying to persuade a bunch of people on the other side that this is what you're going to do when you're actually going to do this other thing, or that this person is actually working for someone else. Or, you know, you're basically trying to fool them. It's generally much more, it's a longer game, and it's a more involved one, and it's, you know, plays out over months and years. But Mission Impossible distills all that down into trying to convince this person or that person of something that's patently not true, and, you know, getting them to act on that, or to get them to do a particular thing or act a certain way to get at the particular MacGuffin they need that week. you know, it's what's normally this game between nations distilled down to these individual actors in this one particular
and
place.
While obviously a lot of spying is just soul-destroying drudgery,
yeah.
It sounds like there are at least a few people, like Tony Mendez, whose books we've been reading recently, who was involved in the Argo mission during the Iranian Revolution, actually did plan and execute just crazy...
The exfiltration of those.
Right.
Yeah.
Just, okay, I'm going to be this other guy, you're going to be this other person, and we're all going to walk right through the people who want to kill us, get on a plane, and be safe as soon as we're out of the country.
Actually, even though it's not really... We could probably draw a tenuous connection between Argo and our 60 spies, because I have read that Tony Mendez actually talked to the makeup guys on Mission Impossible. So we could probably draw a connection there, and then we call up Layton, and we bring the Jack Kirby connection in, and we got a show.
Well... there was an article I sent out that I haven't
had a chance to read it yet. Okay, I've got it on my desktop. I'll read it.
Okay, but you know, there are a lot of, you know, some of the exploits of Mission Impossible, some of the episodes were based very loosely on some actual exploits the CIA engaged in. You know, in particular, there's one episode called The Brothers that is based very loosely on Operation Ajax, which was the CIA essentially putting the Shah back in power in the 50s after the prime minister, you know, started nationalizing everything in Iran. This was not particularly well received by the Iranian people, unsurprisingly. So
turns out there's a reason why those guys who performed the Iranian Revolution 20 years later hated us specifically.
Yeah. Throughout all of the various episodes, there are, you know, there's a two-parter Old Man Out in the first season where there's a, you know, it's...
Which is spectacular, by the way.
Yes, and that's, and I'm going to mangle the name, Cardinal...
Menzinti,
who's a very prominent anti-communist cardinal in the late 40s in Hungary, who was, you know, arrested and tortured into confessing to things he did not do, and then sentenced to an incredibly long prison term. I mean, the Pope excommunicated everyone involved in the trial. He was sprung during the Hungarian Revolution and managed to... He was basically then spent the next 15 years holed up in the American embassy in Hungary after the Soviet Union crushed the Hungarian Revolution, which was, you know, a bit awkward for everyone because the Hungarians denied the U.S. embassy any permit to expand, and they were kind of cramped for space.
As long as the cardinal was in there.
Yeah, and then there were finally a deal was negotiated. He was allowed to, you know, allowed to live in exile in Austria.
The new pope unexcommunicated all of those guys, apparently, and declared him a victim of history rather than a victim of communism specifically, and that was sufficient.
Okay. But that whole episode was basically, you know,
a dissident cardinal in some Eastern European country that we're not going to give the actual
Eastern
name of.
Slavonia.
Right.
And they never check the countries, with the exception maybe of the first Santa Costa, episode. They never name check. It's a South American republic, Mr. Phillips, in danger from its neighbor, or an Eastern European country that's in danger from its neighbor,
a
sinister foreign power, Mr. Phillips. They never really name check the country.
Well, sometimes they do. The first Paris episode where he's basically being Che is it's Nueva Tierra invading San Cristobal.
San Cristobal.
Yeah, I remember that one.
And basically, you know, at the behest of the United People's Republic.
But it was clearly not the Soviet Union.
Peace-loving Soviet peoples would never interfere in the affairs of foreign countries. So I hope you, our fair listener, have deduced how much we genuinely love both the 60s spy stuff by now and this show in particular. There's still a lot left to unpack with Mission Impossible as a television series, as a film series, culturally, and as we lead up to the release of a new Mission Impossible movie this summer, we'll be getting to as much of it as humanly possible. All right, Ray, if you, based so far on Mission Impossible, the television show, what's your one favorite cool thing?
I would have to say the mission briefings. There's a bunch of stuff there, and it's really the classic trope. All of the different bizarre ways they arrange for Dan Briggs and Jim Phelps to show up and get briefed on whatever it is they're going to do. You know, it's just kind of cool. I love the Griffith Observatory one. I think it's probably the favorite one I've seen. The merry-go-round one is a close second.
After a couple of those, I did start to find them, I believe I actually used the phrase, pointlessly elaborate.
And that kind of describes the show in its entirety. So it's you know, it's kind of fitting
Well, like Ray said earlier, it would be easy just to send a guy in with a 35 and... 35 millimeter. A guy in with a 45. 35 millimeter, of course, is film.
Yes.
45 millimeter is a handgun.
No, 45 millimeter is an anti-aircraft gun.
45 caliber. God, I'm getting old. Gentle listener, I'm afraid I am very, very old. I'm actually up to like 137. I take a lot of vitamins. I've had some good plastic surgery. I'm actually very, very old. So, one cool thing, Stacy.
I love heist and con stuff. So, just the structure of the whole thing and the way they carry out the plans, I think. And again, especially the way they kind of tease it. Like, they give you an idea of, okay, we've obviously had this whole conversation about exactly how we're going to do this, but we're only going to show you, like, 3 seconds of it. And then you get to spend the entire episode figuring out what in the world they need a crossbow for.
Yeah. If I had to pick one cool thing, it's that the missions are impossible. It's not run-of-the-mill stuff. It's not, oh, you got to go get the microphone back from this one guy in an office, or you got to go whatever. You know, we think this guy may be working for the Russians. Go find out. It's nothing simple. It's nothing run-of-the-mill. It's nothing commonplace. It's impossible. Mission impossible. It's just the high stakes and the intricacy. You say the pointlessly elaborate nature of it, but that's the point. It's something ridiculous and larger than life and high stakes and unbelievably challenging, except this steely-eyed group of cold warriors will find a way to do that impossible mission. And I just love that. Thank you very much for listening. Now, if you liked the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. Tell your friends. Print it up on t-shirts. That's fine too. Please visit our website at www.agentsof.cool. Also, please follow us on Twitter at agentsofcool. You can email us at ray@agentsof.cool. You can email Stacy at mrspeel@agentsof.cool. And you can email me at number6@agentsof.cool. And again, we really hope our enthusiasm and our love for this genre and this material and this style is coming through. We really do think this stuff is enormously cool. If you enjoy it yourselves, please email us or contact us or tweet to us. We'd love to hear from you. If this is stuff, for some reason, you haven't yet encountered, please go seek some of this out. Try it on Netflix, get the DVD somewhere, and just enjoy it. Just enjoy the cool. Thank you very much for listening, and be sure and tune in next time when we continue our exploration of Mission Impossible.
Have mine turned up too loud, but I keep hearing what might be the howls of the damned or a mighty windstorm in the background of everything we say.
That may be just the breathing noise. Yeah, there's going to be some of that. I'll try to...
Thank you, Lord Vader.
I'll see if I can fix it in post.